We left out, we missed the part where he said there was nothing to do but all go in. And so along came the architect and decided to paint the bridge.
So we all sat in the water and watched this art class spread out all around us, do various angles, paint this old rusty iron railroad trestle. And things were getting cold by the end of the, by the time the art class had pretty well finished. And as they left, the art teacher turned around and she said, "You people sure must like to swim because you stay in the water all the time."
Do you know Will and Kathy's story, Neighbor Rosicky?
No, I don't.
Oh, it's a marvelous story about a Bohemian immigrant family. And the father, on a real hot day, goes swimming in the horse tank with his children. And of course, they just have all taken their clothes off. And that's the time the Norwegian Lutheran pastor decides to come visit. And so he comes over to the watering tank, and the father just puts one of the kids on top of him and sits there and talks to the pastor for half an hour.
Well, we
always love Will and Kathy's book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the
I do too.
Mine's a Neo, my favorite.
Uh-huh. Lovely story. Mm-hmm.
We swim in our car to cow tank, whole family, especially the children, but the night, their night just sleep down through the gate. And it was still 3 feet deep. Mm-hmm. This area that we're sitting in, a bigger, longer,
really?
Almost as big as this room. That's why
it was up on top of the cement, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we'd pick our way through the cow droppings. Cement yard to get to the tank, and then we'd get into the tank. And we had a slide into the tank, and I was buying in quantities, and I wanted to keep the water, the algae out of the water. So I bought a barrel of sulfate from it, copper sulfate.
Copper sulfate.
And I still had about 9/10 of it left. I don't know what happened, but it made the water delightful, very. And one day, Vera and I went down there, and sort of all the cow tanks, that made me crazy. You remember the cow tank and the battery?
Yes, he toddled it along, and his head would be out.
Well,
that was always there when Craig was there.
Well, the details of which children were which, except the Jackie, because we had a slide, they could slide down. And the older girl, Joanne, was up at the top of the slide, and the younger girl was down at the bottom of the slide, and then maybe Jackie, or 2-year-old Jackie, she nearly drowned in there, didn't you say one time?
Yeah, but nobody knew it.
And I said, "What in the world are you children doing?" One of them says, "I'm God." And then one of the bottom says, "I'm Jesus." He said, "And this is a good woman going to heaven."
Going down the slide into that blue.
And then they take and dance all around in the beautiful blue water.
Oh, yes.
Well, I can remember Craig in there too when he was 2. We taught him to swim there before we took him up the lake.
Craig didn't learn to swim there because I remember he walked right down off the dock of the lake right into the water. He dropped his duck in the water and somebody walked in there. He was ready to walk on water.
What lake was this?
Pleasant. We went there about 12 summers.
You were 7 altogether, Mother. Wasn't that long?
Seemed longer than that to me.
Do you remember the Porter Station out here?
I don't remember anything except the sign.
The sign. There was a sign and a siding right out to...
Okay.
My recollection of it was there was nothing much left except an old rotted platform that probably one time was...
They still have a siding there.
And the siding was there.
The old rail.
The siding's still there now. Just as you cross the track by the Turtle Town Hall.
Yeah.
And we were out... We used to call it the Squirrelwoods. We'd walk out past here, past Welty's. And Squirrelwoods was so named because it was a good place to hunt squirrels. And it was quite a walk out back. And this was late one afternoon. We decided to head back. It was a good hour and a half, a couple hours walk to get back. And there was a, you could always tell when the train, there was a train that came by in the afternoon, for a big freight train. At that time they still had steam. This was really warm. And we always waited for the train to go through so we could come back on the little bridges out there. And this time the train came and stopped at Porter Station. And we watched, and they backed a section of the train off into that siding, a bunch of flat cars. And the flat cars were all covered with canvas. And then the train went out. And we walked back up. We got to the siding, and here were all these flat cars with these covers. And of course, the first thing we did was to look under the cover and see what was there. Pried open one cover and crawled under their tanks. Brand new military tanks. Well, you know, to a kid, to have a real live tank, this is our first real connection with the war. We'd seen these things, and you know, to be side by side with a large tank was something that you just couldn't comprehend. And I think we spent a good bit of time exploring around. We couldn't get into them, but I remember getting up on top and underneath this canvas, and there was sort of a light coming through, semi-transparent. You could see what it looked like. I remember the gun turret. And then I recall some voices, and we could hear some men outside. So we knew we were somewhere where we shouldn't be. We figured, well, maybe there was a problem. And voices went by on one side, and we dropped out on the other side, and all would have gone well, except instead of walking around the length of the thing, of the string of tank flat cars, we crossed through, and we came out right in front of two men. And they immediately came up to us and asked us our names, where we live, what we were doing. Turned out that this was a secret run. These were new tanks of some new type. And they put it here, and these fellows were here to guard the thing until the next train came and was going to take them somewhere. And they were to be made up as part of another train. And we had, of course, seen the tank. And the dilemma of these men, they didn't really know what to do with us. On the other hand, they knew we'd seen this stuff. And so we swore ourselves to secrecy. And I think to this day those men were very diplomatic. And they had us raise our hand and swear on oath to God and country that we would never tell about the tanks at the siding until the war was then after that. Yeah. And we never did.
Think of the thrill that you felt playing those tanks. Must have felt almost like spies.
It was a first real connection with a real thing of the war.
And,
you went to Roosevelt, didn't you?
Yes.
Was Miss Glenn the principal at that time?
Jones, Pop Jones, we called it.
Pop Jones.
Charlie Jones.
Miss Glenn was followed him, I think.
Yes.
No, Miss Glenn would have been
preceded.
Miss Glenn
before.
Preceded him, because I had him.
I had Miss Glenn in seventh grade, and then I went to Arizona.
And I had Miss Glenn,
how
you see.
How old do you have?
48.
Okay, you. I preceded you by 4 years then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember the name. I knew her name. But
well, I brought her up. You talked about walking out along the railroad track and so forth. She was a great bird watcher, and she and Sanders and I would drive around, but she was bothered by squirrels, and she didn't like to kill all the little bees, so she'd catch them in a box trap in her yard on Central Avenue, and then she'd take them out to the woods that I had on Cali Road, farther up the hill farm right on the corner of Cali Road, and I had to release them in this 20 acres of woods. And she would release them in there. And I had a friend that liked to hunt squirrels. And I, you know, yard, past the yard. And we went in where I had never seen. Squirrels.
Well, do you know the Scoltons? Joy Scolton's on
that. I've never heard that story about Miss Glenn and the squirrels in the woods.
Well, they have a problem with squirrels too. They live in their house and their attic and all of
Joy.
Scolton? Yeah, 816 Wisconsin. It's really
You've
been to their house. And so he did that one winter. He had several have a heart traps. And he told us he carted 30-some squirrels out of his yard and took them to Big Hill Park, somewhere across the river, so he hoped they wouldn't
figured they
get
wouldn't,
back.
They wouldn't cross water.
I could just see him with those squirrels in his car.
Well, Grandpa Dalvin did that, too. He
was a little rabbit.
He caught rabbits and squirrels and found something.
We should do that with woodchucks.
Well, Charlie Jones, the principal, we call it Roosevelt. Because that's what he called it, Roosevelt. He said Roosevelt. He couldn't say Roosevelt, so we all said Roosevelt. And Charlie was called Pop, and I think there was a certain amount of affection to the term. It wasn't derogatory in any sense. Because he had a way with kids that I don't think was school taught. He just had a way. There were certain rules that Pop laid down. One was swimming in the creek during noon. Stronghold was right across the railroad track from the school. And on a warm day, it would be dripping with sweat in the class home. And it was nice to go over the tracks and down to the Stronghold and soak up the waters of the creek. And Pop had a very simple way of determining who'd been in the creek. After lunch, he'd come into the classes, he had a comb, and he'd run the comb through your hair, check it for mud.
I think it was Miss Merriman that you shot in the eye of the
I think it was Miss Merriman.
Poor Miss Merriman. No wonder she retired.
This is one I told yesterday to this lady, Sherry. Edward was complaining that when we were kids about your age, I apparently was using the leader of the shenanigans and they could get it in the neck, but this is one time where I really got it. We had gotten some squirt guns for about 50 cents, which was quite a bit in those days. They weren't plastic, they were all metal, and they were repeaters. They were about 5 shots. And beautifully done in metal. Because of the war time, they were hard to get, so they got to the 42 as well. About the next day, and my father brought us both guns to school, off and on, shot, which meant we could squirt each other. At one point, Edward aggravated me, and I guess he got me in the face. So I turned on him and was chasing him down the hall, and he went lying by him, was Merriman's room. She went and stuck her head up, opened the door right in the line of fire. This now's pretty good aim. Got her right in the face. And she took me right to Miss Glenn, and Miss Glenn sized it all up, slapped me, took the gun, and I chased and went back to class with tears in my eyes. Tried to negotiate with the janitor to find my gun later. The pickup had been made. I never got the gun back.
Dumped it right in the wastebasket.
Yeah, Edward was very pleased with that story.
I have to edit these Silver Slophouse. He said it's Silver Slophouse.
Oh, really? Did he? Down
I thought they called it Fritz's Flophouse.
Oh, what a place. He did sell it.
He said he doesn't care to be a landlord.
You remember Urbach, don't you?
Oh, for sure.
And you remember the story of the Chandler? They found a... this would be what, John?
Probably he's in
time. John was older.
Yeah. Tom was younger and John was older.
It was either, I can't remember, it was Tom or John, or both involved in the thing.
That's really.
They discovered an old Chandler touring car out on a farm out here, just out about where I see where Max Dodson lived. this next place over. There's a big old barn out there. And they towed it into Erbach's house in Milwaukee Road. And it was an old touring car, just red with rust. And had a six-cylinder antique-looking engine. So they sanded, scraped, put orange paint on it. Got orange paint. I think at that time the ironworks was using orange paint on the Corvette engine, so Erbach's father who worked there got this horrible orange, bright orange paint. I still see that car. Just, we all painted it. They told us that we helped them paint to get it right. And so we got this thing all beautiful painted up. They had the thing backed up about maybe 10 feet from the garage door and for the startup. One of the Erbachs got on the crank and got the thing spinning it over with the crank, really clip. I think Tom was in the driver's end and he was working the throttle and the spark and he got things mixed up. And it let off with a terrific backfire. And a squirrel had filled the muffler with nuts. And they came out of just like a machine gun. And at that time, Erbach's garage door had about three rows of glass. Okay. It had cleaned it out. There just wasn't a pane of glass left in that thing. It just sprayed, and it was just a shotgun effect. And the glass all went out of the door. And the car started, the engine took off, and everybody was tearing around and so happy that the car was running. We all got in and drove out the driveway just as poor Mr. Erbach came out of the back door. And all he saw was shattered glass and acorns, and everybody else was down the road.
That's a marvelous story.
We had an old Chandler's good.
Who had the Franklin with the slope roof? Because the slope took when I was in high school.
We
saw, no. I was saying, who did? It was one of the students, Erbach. Fry had Chloe, a 34 Chevy.
Jack Fry
had Chloe.
Did you ever see him when you're here?
No, but I had to give him a call. It's been a long
time. Oh, he has such a character.
This channel of ours, we go to Chicago, I put in a gallon of oil and I carry a gallon along. And finally, piston rod went through the casing and
That's looked so good,
you know,
on the outside.
We were taking
it to
these there. Well, a few kids
have had it, you'd have... They'd fix it up, made it run again.
They'd have had a good time.
Put oversized pistons in it. Mm-hmm. The new
well, there was a great period of trying to make these scooters, these go-kart things, the Travis's go. Of course, speed was the ultimate, and there were several engines involved that were good. There was a twin-cylinder Maytag that was a washing machine engine, and there was a single-cylinder, and that was somewhat feeble, but the twin-cylinder was determined that if you did certain things to the engine, you could get the thing spinning. And one of them was tying down the governor so that literally the thing ran. The faster you went, the faster the engine ran. We had one on a bicycle. This was about the time of the Whizzer came out right after the war, the first sort of, I guess we called them open today. And not being able to afford anything that fancy, we rigged these Maytags on regular bicycles. It really was quite dangerous because your feet were inches away from this spinning flywheel. And you get on the bike and pull the rope and get the thing spinning. And then we had a pulley we let down, and a belt grabbed a hole, and a belt around the big ship, and we were off. There was no control, no brakes, no nothing. The only way you could stop was either jump off the bike or stop the engine and let the thing coast. And at the time, I think one of the neighbors, I'm going to say, Pat Cunningham, had a brand new, this was one of the first Cadillacs after the war, beautiful thing. He had it parked out in the street. I came down Emerson Street, made the curve. I'm not sure what I had. I was going maybe 40 miles an hour on a short bike, this thing wide open. And I remember
to grow up.
I remember a sound as we went by, as I went by Cut's new Cadillac, and the sound was the piston rod broke. The piston went through the end of the case and into the door of the Cadillac as I went by and left this beautiful and nice sculpture hole in the side of the Cut's new Cadillac.
What did you do? Did you confess?
Oh, well, he was right there. There was no problem.
Oh, no problem.
Of course,
I'm surprised you ever became Mrs. Hornbostel.
You see, I never knew him these days.
You weren't one of those girls next door.
One of our friends said it took half a long time to grow up, but by the time he had, that's when I met him.
You weren't one of the Caldwell girls.
No.
Well, you know, the things that you guys did, too, which are high adventure and things like that. Kids nowadays, if they did those things, they'd be juvenile delinquents.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I think you made your own time. It was partly the war.
We used to joust on bicycles after the war. And I guess I made things better in old days because I can't remember many bicycles or pieces. They didn't smoke, but then straight them out.
Yeah, they were tough. Well, we had one contrivance. We had a bicycle mounted on the remains of an old canoe. It was quite easy. Wood canoes they didn't last, and it was quite easy. You could find remains of wooden canoes. Sometimes people would leave them down along the creek or on the river. And this was one of these old spots in old town canoes. And we saw a CB type device. It was a paddle wheel thing, again, in the war movies. And the idea was, well, let's emulate this thing. So we took a bicycle, and took the front wheel off, and mounted the frame in the canoe, and then cut a hole. Actually, cutting the transom off in the back of the canoe, and then we put wood boards tied to the spokes in the rear wheel. So when you pedaled, essentially you had this thing, paddle wheel, flipping around. And we played with the thing in the creek, and it was fairly successful. It'd go for a while, and then you'd flounder and go in. But the endurance of the bicycle, you know, it got wet, it got covered with mud, and all the gearing and everything. It never failed. It kept running. And that thing would run.
How long did you go before it filled up the water?
We had a block. We had a section put in where this thing was cut out. The thing was, it was so tippy, and you were up on this thing. It was a balancing act. But the jousting, I remember that was the idea was to build two of these, and then you could joust. Well, we never got another one built because we were always trying to keep the first one afloat. The ultimate was to try and get some kind of a game going. Yeah, going where you can pedal and beat each other.
A colleague of mine the other day was reading a paper in a greater writing class. He said, "What's a chicken fight? Is there such a word for that?" He never had kids, so he didn't know what a chicken fight was.
Didn't know what a chicken fight was.
I said, "Sure, there's such a word."
Chicken hunt?
A chicken fight.
Oh.
You sit on another person's shoulders in the water, especially. And then the object is to, you wrestle, you sort of hand wrestle, and you try and get the one who's on the shoulders off. The other team, and the other pair. Our kids used to do it all the time. Isn't it in the water? Is that how you do it?
Or on land.
You could do it on land,
yeah.
Too.
It was easier to unseat somebody in the water because the person holding the underside, the chicken legs, could be tipped, you know. If the person on the top got a blow, that was often hard to hold your balance and keep your rider upright.
Well, I think it was just a matter of you growing up during times when you weren't supervised. Because your parents were either working long hours or they were in the war.
Yeah, that's the same too, but today, I think also you couldn't boss them.
Yeah, there weren't toys, there weren't video games.
Oh, well, kids have got radio and television, but they don't need to use their imagination.
I think that's a great inhibitor.
See, it's more vicious than
close to the high school.
What about you putting sugar in?
Some of the kids seem like, what?
What about the sugar?
Boys will be boys, huh? Mm-hmm. When you put sugar in that guy's gas tank.
Well, that wasn't viciousness, that was hijinks. Imagine, right back, you tell that story. Jim Lee's girlfriend, Ivana, was at stake, as was John Elder. And I think Kressner, towards the community. And Jim Lee's. And we were just driving around. He had to be senior, high school, 17 years old. And we drove by Jim Lee's girlfriend's house, and there was a strange car. I forget who in the back seat noticed that I had loaded groceries. I hadn't taken home yet. Somebody came up with, "If you ever put sugar in a gas tank, they'll know we haven't." I think it was Jim Means. But we staked it out, and we had never done anything quite like this before. But I was at the corner with a getaway car, and Jim Hayes and Jim Means couldn't be seen, of course, but Jim Hayes and John Eldred, I guess, walked by nonchalantly and stood there against the car while the third member came up, I guess that was Kressner, opened the gas tank, poured 5 pounds of gas in, and they sauntered off. And we took off, thought it was high adventure.
Where's that 5 pounds of gas?
5 pounds of sugar, sorry. And unbeknownst to us, why the young man and the girl were watching. And it was Chief of Police Bloomer. That was his daughter. A few days later, Jim Means came into the barber shop, which is next to Rosman and Kinsey's. Who would that be? He's still at it.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Don Austin's dad, Mr. Yeah. Austin. Uh-huh. I was having my hair cut. Jim said, you got $150? And I said, anything over a dollar and a quarter is a rumor to me. He said, well, we gotta come up with it. You'll be getting a call. He'd already been subpoenaed. At any rate, the poor fellow got about, they didn't know what we were doing. But he got about halfway to Monroe and his car conked out, and he had to, couldn't get a ride that night. He had to walk about 10 or 12 miles at 3 in the morning.
Well, it completely froze the engine.
No, it didn't, no. As it turned out, the filters, as we understood, it filters sufficiently that, and we were showed, it doesn't dissolve particularly well. And all it does is clog up the filters, and so the car stopped, but it didn't ruin the motor. And so they had testimony to that. At any rate, they're very grim fathers. Drove to Monroe to see the district attorney and see if we could arrive at some reasonable solution. When I came home from the barber shop, Dad was working in the warehouse with Johnny Sapp, who later became a sheriff. But anyway, I told Dad what the problem was, and I've never seen Dad so furious. He stormed up and down. Didn't hit me. Couldn't understand myself. He's so dumb to do something like that. And such a delinquent. Turned to Johnny Sapp for reassurance, and Johnny said, "Oh, Ron, I did those things in that when I was a kid." But it was settled out of court.
Well, it was settled by John's father and Mean's father.
And you
and I. I don't know whether Fritz Gutzon went over.
No, he didn't go over.
He didn't go over.
He was the one that didn't go, but the three of us drove over and looked at this guy and talked him around. I think you're wrong about it. We didn't see any attorneys over there. Sorry.
We were threatened at any rate.
We asked him what it would take to fix it from $750.
And I paid my part of it with $25 I won for the first prize of the VFW contest, an essay of what America means to me.
these stories are about John Eldred and Ed Gressner, Jim Hayes for a while was pretty well known.
You had one in the paper here that included him.
Yeah, there was a newer trolley ride.
Paps on Halloween, and he worked at Walsh's, and he learned about cabbages, and especially rotten cabbages. Okay, go on, Hap. There were nights before Halloween.
Each night was designated as a particular event. Cabbage night was one night, garbage can night was one night, and then, of course, it was the actual event of Halloween. And the names centered around the use of these particular devices to generally harass, particularly the police. I think the best use of cabbage was what we call a car drop. The police patrolled the streets very slowly, and they watched for most anything. And right after they went underneath the streetlight, they couldn't see momentarily. So we hang a rotten cabbage in a sling out over the wire that went out by the light. They couldn't see it. And then we time it, we lay in the bushes along, and I remember old Miller's house over here across the street. There's a bush road was right next to the street and the sidewalk. You could hide there. And then you time it as a car, as a squad car slowly came by, you let this mass of rotten slush down, and it would just engulf the windshield if the squad car was properly done, and bring them to a halt. And you'd see these doors open and these police coming out on either side, and momentarily blinded by the light and the rot and the smell of the rotten cabbage, they gave you enough time to escape. Garbage can night was an attempt to redistribute. I think we were probably the first people to invent the landfill, because generally the idea was to the most effective way to redistribute the contents of a garbage can, and in many cases involved a squad car. And one of the tricks was that people would put their garbage cans out along the side of the street, as they do today. They kept them out there. The garbage was picked up. So it wasn't unusual to see several cans out along the edge of the street. At least they didn't think it was. And there was a vice known as a tip. And what it amounted to was, we used to make them out of wood. It was a little piece of wire attached to a 12-inch ruler that you'd lay in the street. And the wire was up the little hook. You had a line attached to this, and as a squad car slowly drove over, it caught the bumper and pulled the garbage can off. So the squad car went on down the street and tipped and sprayed the contents of the garbage can all over the street before they got stopped. And the device was the most foolproof thing, you know, next to a mousetrap, I think, was probably the most ingenious device I've ever seen.
Describe it again. How did it kiss the bumper?
Well, the unit was a piece of wire. The bottom half was, we used to put it on a ruler, a 12-inch ruler, which we supported. The upper half was vertical with a little hook. It was just high enough so as the car drove over, the squad car drove over, it would catch underneath the bumper, the running gear of the car. Then we had this hooked to a line that went back to one or two garbage cans that were just along the side of the road. And so it jerked the cans off the curb and rattled them down the street, spewing the garbage all over the street.
And the cops would be doing it. That's
yeah. And they, of course, you know, there was never anyone around. I remember seeing the poor devils getting out, trying to get fingerprints off the ruler on the road, trying to figure out. It was one of the most frustrating
things. If your son had done something like that, he'd get a hit.
Were you ever in on, was it you were just hearsay about putting the bag with not liquid?
Oh, Craig did that.
But we're very soft manure.
I just provided the raw materials.
See, we can write that up and put around barn because the cow pancakes came out of the Dogan Fields. This was Craig and his cronies.
Well, this was the old paper bag and fire trick.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
But they always put it on Superintendent Daywald's
yes,
front porch.
That was a ritual too.
Oh, yeah. So that they were all going.
I'm sure he looked forward to it. That went on for 5 years.
Oh, gee.
We even made one final run as seniors in high school. We were much too old for that, for old time's sake.
Well, I have a friend who is the principal of a school near a little town near Springfield, who did all these kind of escapades. He was probably about your age, Hap, and doing about the same things at the same time. And he had a refinement of the paper bag trick, which was that they would fix the screen door and fix it in such a way that it wouldn't open. And then here was the fire, and people would, something they did with toothpicks. He wrote it all up in one story. And so the person would be coming rushing out to put the fire out and would hit the screen door to try to get it open. I mean, hit the usual way that opened the screen door, and it wouldn't open, so that they'd go right through the screen. and then they would, because I suppose most people, they didn't have their screens up by their storm doors up by end of October.
Happened only gotten as far as the cabbage night and the garbage can night.
Okay, what other special nights did you have?
Well, I think Halloween was
outhouse night.
There was outhouse, I think, was associated with Halloween. Halloween was a night of, I think the objective was to transport as much from one place to another on Halloween night as you could. And outhouses were, you know, to see outhouses everywhere around town was just, I think, common. You almost expected the next day to see them spread around town. And,
the Francis Willard outhouse was a good one.
But I think the trick I remember most on Halloween involved balloons and oil. You take a balloon and fill it with about, maybe a quart or 2 quarts of motor oil, and particularly old motor oil. And when this burst, it just made a complete mess on the street. It was very slippery. And we'd leave these, they're hard to see. We'd leave them out in the street, particularly before a cop car was coming. The police would come down and hit these things. And the car would just go into a tailspin. And they'd spin around, and they'd just be, you know, completely lost and stuff. And then they'd get out, and they'd fall over. And you know, you could watch this thing and just, you know, laugh, and tears coming out of your eyes until these poor devils, you know, got themselves back in a position where they could stand up again. But it just, that was, I think, one of our favorite tricks.
You haven't told us anything about your appearing before Judge Christensen or...
Did you ever?
Oh, there were times.
I never heard about those either.
Seems like a rather fiendish mind.
I mean,
out loose.
Couldn't have gotten off scot-free every time.
No, I think there were...
Tradition or something, sorry.
There were times that we, I recall one time when we were really caught red-handed. It involved the stable down here, horses. The stable, was it Smith's?
Smith's. Well, McKillop's ever came.
Yeah, Smith had the old barn.
He used to have a bigger stable out in Broad Street or somewhere.
And he kept the barn down here, and he had, I'd say maybe 10 or 12 horses.
Well, I bet.
And had them, people around here, I think, just had them for riding. And he was a pretty crusty type. He didn't like us because he liked people who gave him money. And he caught on right away that there was no money involved in us whatsoever. So there wasn't any reason to like us. So we, naturally, we took a dislike to him. And there was Halloween night, and we strung some firecrackers along the fence. And he had a little lean-to next to the stable there where we lived. And so we thought we'd wake him up late at night. The thing we didn't realize, that all the horses, we couldn't see out in the field, but all the horses were right in this one corner of the field. So we strung all these cherry bombs up and lit the thing off, and it just sounded like Omaha Beach there for a few minutes. And lights went on, and then we heard this sound of fences breaking. And the horses bolted, every one of them took out. There were horses all over the east side of Hawaii. And we ran home, and the next morning, policeman knocked on the door and wanted to talk about horses. And we said that we had some experience with them that night. We ended up, I think, the restitution was repairing the fence, and humble apologies to Smith, but he never spoke to us after that. No, he never spoke.
Well, did he just suggest you guys as the possible ones,
yeah,
or had,
yeah,
you hadn't left any clues?
No, he just knew. I think he figured it was. He knew that this life was there, and he just put two and two together. I think often, though, we worked on the side of the law, strangely enough. The railroad detectives during the war, there was periods where these bums would ride the trains, and they'd steal the lenses out of the signals. And I don't recall what their use was, whether they used them for pots or cooking or something, but they had a use for these things. And they'd take the lenses out, and then, of course, you wouldn't see the red or the green signal. And the railroad hired some detectives to patrol, particularly down here at this junction, and one up here at Porter, to see what was going on. And the detective also would confiscate any ammunition if he found some kids along and saw them shooting at insulators or something. So we got to know this one detective and made a deal with him. And he would give us the ammunition that he had confiscated from the other kids. And in return, of course, we wouldn't shoot at the insulators, but in return, we'd watch for the signal problem because we were down there. And as it turned out, I think it was 75, the train that was going south. We were down one day, and sure enough, these two chaps hopped off the train and climbed up the signal and started unscrewing these things. And he told us that if we saw anything, there was an old telephone on the post. There was a little shed there. And he said all we had to do was stick a stick through, and there was a hole in that. Case, we stuck a stick through, we could trip the handle off the phone. And so we did that, and then they got a busy signal downtown. And they got these chaps. And we didn't know this, but about 3 weeks later we saw him. And he came over and he said, come on over to the shed. He said, I've got something I think you'd like. Went over and he gave us each of us a case of 1,000 rounds of .22 ammunition, which in those days was like, you know, gold. I mean, that was a year's supply.
That's a fine round.
And there was a relationship there that was established, not formal, but there was a respect.
There's no truer way to find out what's going on when we have the kids in there. We lose an animal.
So I think it worked both ways. We had certain relationships were established.
Well, we've got some apple pie that Scotty made. Would you like a good piece of apple pie? Okay, let's go do that, Craig.
I think a very...
Here's a Helen Hopkins story.
We had a great deal of respect for Helen Hopkins, because she ruled with a firm hand, and her firm hand included a paddle.
Yeah.
And
I never used that paddle. That's because I probably never was able to see it in the air.
She had one. And Helen, most of the teachers there, I think, understood us, or at least we had reached a truce where that there was a certain point where the extension of learning just was unable to move on. And I remember Helen Herman. She understands very well that way.
Yeah, she's still around.
But there was one young lady who was bound determined to bring us to the brink of the cultural gap. And in 1 year, converted us from small town delinquents to big city folk. And she became the bane of our existence. We decided something had to be done. And it was around springtime when the creek floods here. And the pools, after the water recedes, the pools are filled with fish. It's quite easy to go down and spear carp, big old carp. And we always had a surplus of them. Of course, most of them went in the garden. But in this case, one went to Todd's school and ended up behind the radiator in this teacher's room. And spent the weekend cooking behind the radiator. And Monday morning, I remember approaching Todd's school and being rather astounded at all the windows were open because it was still rather cool. And every single window of the school was open. There wasn't a window that wasn't open.
What grade were you in?
Oh, this would be fourth grade, I think third or fourth grade.
Julian?
No, Julian had left by then.
Oh, well, then I wouldn't know.
And,
that's too bad. You can't pin it on.
Because she wasn't that offensive. There must have been somebody after her.
We walked in the school, and I have to say that it definitely smelled of fish. And we went to our classroom, our homeroom, and it wasn't very long until Miss Hopkins came to the door and asked if we'd come to the office.
People always knew where to go.
Yes.
I'd like to know who the we.
There were two involved in this one. Chap by the name of Bob Crines. That's, I think, the other culprit.
You and Bob Crines?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so Bob and I went to the office, and she walked over, and she had one of these old-style trash containers. She opened up the lid, and it was obvious what was in the trash container, and she put the lid back down rather quickly and asked us if we knew what that was. And we said, well, we certainly thought it was a dead fish. And she asked us if we knew how the fish got there. And we said, well, really, we didn't. But she said, well, what I'm asking is, we found it behind this radiator. And we had to admit that we had something to do with that.
I could have been a liar.
I think you could have at least gotten out of that one.
Well, there was.
I think that would be the direct lie.
There was the. And so she got out the paddle and gave each of us a good lashing. But I think there's a moral to the story, because the next week the teacher was gone. So I think Miss Hopkins understood the problem finally, I think. She
sped her on her way.
Yeah, she sped the teacher on her way, so it was a hollow victory.
What school was it at?
Todd's school.
Todd's school.
Our children enjoy Todd. Very much, and they do.
Yeah,
it was a continuity in those days. I had the same teachers all the way through that my oldest sister, 5 years old. Exception of Mr. Drew.
Yeah, Dale Durant's out there. He became principal after she retired.
Yeah, he was
a
nice.
He's been a principal for a long time.
Very good.
He had
struck
a Robinson, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we all had Ellen Herman and
Miss Ross,
Miss Kelly,
Miss Winter,
Miss Williams, Miss Herman.
Miss Julian was fourth grade. Miss Hurst was fifth grade, and then Dale Durant was sixth grade.
Miss Hurst and I. Had problems from time to time. I loved her, but she's a disciplinarian, and I was feeling that I was about fifth grade. Edward and I learned how to talk hand language because of my deaf grandpa. And Ed could communicate with grandpa, too. He was out at the farm so often. One time, we were hurling insults at Miss Hurst. Colloquialisms that we shouldn't have been using in fifth grade. Miss Earth understood hand language.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
I was slapped. And I believe Ed was slapped, too. But she waited until he saw what we were saying. Might use that in the wrong barn.
Well, maybe it isn't directly connected with the... Well, yes, it's using the grandpa deaf language, so that would be the connection, yeah.
Did you learn sign language, too?
Yeah, we all us kids did, practically. Mm-hmm.
Can you still do it here?
Oh, not very fast.
Ours is just alphabet.
We just couldn't spell things, but Grandpa could go lickety-split.
I don't know why Grandpa never learned the honest-to-goodness hand language where you can
really communicate.
I am going to church. Mm-hmm. Well, if I wanted to say that, I... And, I could write it pretty fast, but I couldn't read it well.
Have you ever seen the play Children of the Lesser God?
No.
It uses it's a story of a girl in a school.
Sign language format all through.
Yeah, and a teacher who comes to work in the school. It's a very interesting play. It's all done in hand sign language. He speaks at the same time as he's doing it, and he reads hers out loud. And the part of the woman was originally played by a man who couldn't speak. Mm-hmm. Just did sign language. It was a peninsula.
I went to college with two girls who were from deaf parents. And the deaf parents had four girls who were all normal because their deafness was caused by different things, so that they didn't pass on any. And these girls were all beautiful and talented and very pretty. And I went to school in Jacksonville, Illinois, and they had a deaf school there and a blind school. And these girls had been raised, of course, with the real sign language, and they, just to translate, they often brought the deaf children over to the college to concerts or things that were going on, plays. And these girls would stand up and translate for them. And their hands were so beautiful, they did it just like a dance almost. And we used to just were aghast at how much they accomplished. They were named Hasenstab, and there was Grace and Constance and Joyce and Beatrice, all ending in C-E. Yeah. And they were noted far and wide. Constance became a bishop to the deaf. Her father had been a bishop to the deaf. They were lovely, lovely people. And you're talking about that reminded me of the Hasenstab family.
Yeah, at St. James Cathedral in Chicago, we have a minister to the deaf who stands through the whole mass toward the back third of the church.
It can be very beautiful.
Very interesting watching.
I have a letter from Grandpa Dogan to his son Trevor, where he's complaining good-naturedly enough, but he's saying that he has a problem with his people writing to him when they go anywhere. He says, some of them are like mother and you, and and somebody else that don't think that that what's being said is worth listening to. And so they don't tell me what's being said. He said, or then it's like you've gone to a meeting with Stam the night before, the milkman. And Stam had been his writer, Or like Stam and somebody else, they become so interested in what's being said that they forget to write for me. Mm-hmm. So either way, I am left without knowing what's going on.
I'm never comfortable with anyone if they're on my left side. Because I wrote for my father so much with my right hand and he on my right side. If I have anybody over here, I feel something wrong. Horses drive on one side.
That's something I'd never heard you say before, Dad, so I want to be sure I got it on here. Which is that you never feel comfortable with somebody on your left side, you said? Because you were used to
having
Grandpa on your right to write for him.
But how could I?
Yeah, I guess I knew about horses too. My horse would only respond on one side.
Well, the hard part is the dirt.
Where she likes to be.
I am so glad that this worked out.
Well, I'm so glad you got all of us together for a long time. I wouldn't have otherwise.
This is a story I haven't heard before about Daddy's Model T, 1913.
Mm-hmm. 12.
So I had to have some coil and put the fire pump on the day when I started some of the night down there. But I drove that a couple of years, and it was a really sports car. Somebody had taken the springs and somewhere or other, I put them underneath the axle. And it had a canvas top. And we could carry 8 people in it. Girl would sit on my lap, and the guy next to me would have the girl on his lap. And then I got the running board,
What did Grandpa Dogan think of your having that car?
I don't know.
I'm sure you must have gotten a blistering letter, because he wrote a blistering letter to Trevor about getting rid of a car. With the final line being, think, grow great, and walk.
One story I remember that about that car particularly, the four of us in that car. Now, when I had a girl in my lap, and I couldn't get my foot up on the handrail.
Dempster.
North Avenue. And one of the grand old dance halls in Arlington, or doesn't matter. At any rate, my companion said that I wouldn't be able to kiss my girl. By the time the dance was over, so I circled around the place. and I didn't get the courage. Then we got back into this car and headed home instead of going to the main drive. That's why I kept along the railroad track, and it was raining just terribly. And he was still poking me in the ribs and wondering. My girl was on my shoulder, you know. And, well, I got awfully tired of him apprehensive about the whole situation, because this girl understands that she got home from the day when she'd get in bed with her mother with her shoes on, tell her all about it. But anyway, I found a good deep mud hole, saw the car. I wouldn't try to switch on. I let him bang his back in the
ground. Pretty good.
But, and then I got up the courage to kiss her after I got going. And she claimed she was asleep and didn't, hadn't ever remembered. We've known her since, you know, all these years since then.
No. That was the girl, huh?
And she married this guy.
She married Wally Clore?
Yeah.
And she was the one that you kissed when she was asleep?
Yeah.
Some kiss.
Couldn't even get credit for it.
The boy that was a roommate of mine had to go west for his health. And he was a gal steady. So he left her in my care and Wally's care. Well, we go up to her house the Sunday afternoon or something of that sort. And we were around the house a while, and then she and Wally would suggest going to church. Episcopal Church or something. Well, I passed out on that.
I'd go home, but I see now that it was a rigged situation because then Wally had it to himself. He married her.
Your friend died out there, didn't he?
Larry died.
Larry died of TB, wasn't it? So she didn't have him to
Jackie,
come back.
Jackie, did you ever listen to Garrison Keillor's book?
Yes, we've been enjoying that.
I'm just a fan since he's gone nationwide.
This is from Airwaves?
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that a marvelous
My wife gave me the book just before I left. And
there's a book on it?
Yes, it's called, I'm Glad You Are Here, or I'm Glad I Am Here.
I was just chuckling over a little paragraph in there that in his talk he's he talked about this couple that was visiting that had been married 32 years. But I grew up 30 or 40 years ahead of you. But I lived part of the time on Bushland Street across from Strong School in Vermont. And we didn't have gangs in those days. We had informal associations. I mean, one of these days we'd be released with two fellows, and those four or five fellows would be. And we all had air guns. And so there was about four or five blocks around there that really weren't safe for either.
Man or beast.
I don't know how he grew up with all our eyes.
I was wishing there had been a picture of the
Chevron. Yeah. I can remember one of the my father was totally against guns, and very much opposed to the idea of a firearm. Mainly because I think his grandfather liked them. There was a relationship that my grandfather liked, my dad disliked. And so when I approached him for a BB gun or an air rifle, the pump Daisy. And there was a double barrel that was particularly desirable.
Oh boy, I got that far.
There was no way. And I decided the only way to break into the situation was to break out of it. And maybe you remember Dr. Marshall, the black doctor that lived up there on Sherwood. Well, we got to know Dr. Marshall mainly. We go over and listen to the stories of his recollections of the Civil War. He was born, I think, right after the war, but his father had been in the war and freed as a slave, and so he knew the war, and his stories were really something. And I always, my eye caught a rifle above the fireplace, and an old Springfield, so-called 45-70, the old Hinchback. Belonged to his father and been given to the father, I guess, after the war, carried on through. And I don't know why, but one day he caught me looking at the thing. And he said, would you like it? Well, I was torn. I knew what it meant to him, and I also knew what would happen if I brought it home. But both sides of the conflict was resolved mentally when I got the rifle and brought it home. And I told my father that it was no good, all rusty, and you could see it was shape, and therefore it was perfectly safe because it wouldn't shoot. And he agreed to let the rifle in the house. And so that started an effort to rebuild the rifle very secretly. We worked on that thing, we cleaned it all up, worked on our hours scrubbing the bore to get the rust out of it, get the rifle back to it, be all right. Got the thing to where it was finally it all really very nicely put together. And we took it back to the old doctor to show him. And Dr. Marshall, he literally wept. He saw that thing. And he remembered what it was like. He said, you know, he said, I've got something I forgot to give you. He came back with a case of cartridges. Well, from there on in, I shot the first round went, remember the old Smith stables?
Yeah.
Well, it took off.
No, it's Smith. You mean out here on Colley Road?
The one down here in Colley Road.
The old guy right there across from the gun club.
Yeah, across from the gun club. Well, the first round, went through a bale of hay and through the corner of Smith's Stables, and that's when we appreciated the effect of a rifle. And from there on in, we set up a range down there along the creek, and things got better, and that started the eternal lifelong association with the old antique firearms. I never did get a new gun. I've never had a new gun.
You saw this again.
Yes, that was a good comment. Dad's distaste for guns didn't rub off on you. No. I saw you then to the.
All right, well, then it's still
guns
in there.
I'd like to hear the story of every one of you sleep down.
Yeah, that's really something you should read.
Yeah, it's more fancy.
Well, you said you've been writing up some things for your company paper.
Well, we did a serial. We called it War Kids. And we took a series of these stories and put them together in a format around kids growing up during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And told them in through the eyes of one of the kids. And the characters are all, the names are all changed, but they're basically, they're true stories about this area. There are a number in there that are
the one about the fertilizer.
The great fertilizer. This actually, I'm not sure whether it was your farm or this goes back to World War II when we had victory gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always a contest in Beloit to have the best victory garden, the largest tomatoes. It was a patriotic event. So there was a tremendous amount of competition to grow the best produce. Fertilizer was a secret, and pig fertilizer was considered the best. And our neighbors had in the backyard, which sloped slightly, unfortunately, towards the house, had put in a beautiful garden. And one spring we discovered that Walsh's across the way had liquid pig, and they put this stuff in. So we ditched all around the garden to obtain this. And then he came in with a tank truck and ladled it. I remember that real mirror pond. We could just see the stuff growing. And I went to bed, and I remember it rained. And one thing we hadn't counted on was rain. At that time, we didn't understand the relationship between dikes and rain and water coming up. And that thing burst. And the next morning, there was all our through down. We'd run into the laundry and the house.
Oh.
It was all summer really before we got that stuff
And then did it go over into the neighbors?
It went into the neighbors. They were upset.
The place must have stank. I mean, cow manure is one thing, but pig manure is.
And fish meal is another.
And I green. That's in you our house, always, right? The scene of the crime was repeated for several years because there was always green grass. Exactly the area where that stuff flowed. Well, it always came back this nice, dark, rich green grass. The rest of the yard was a little brown.
I don't know why I used to hear great stories about the Hornbach up there.
Yes, yes. Who was it? Oh, Mrs. Bartholomew. We were up in Door County this summer. We had lunch with Bob Bartholomew and Barbara, Mrs. Bartholomew.
Mm-hmm.
She told a story about, what was it, taking you up in Germany? Germany was just weird as hell. You know, all the shenanigans.
Snakes. I think snakes are intertwined in your life in some form or other. Always something to do with snakes provoke screams in young girls, and that, of course, an advantage. The chap next door, Ralph Fisher, had a yard man who was deathly afraid of snakes. Couldn't get near a snake. And in the springtime, they had to open up a large cover and go down underground in a pit to turn on the city water from his yard. And that pit was always, it was a brick drywall. The thing was always full of snakes, just crawling over things. In the springtime, they were catching on. You go down, it just looked like you were surrounded by a wall of spaghetti. Beautiful.
Oh, wow.
It was always worth about $10 because he'd give us a nickel a snake. And we'd go down in this thing and we'd pull the snakes out of their cracks and throw them up. There'd be someone standing there with a basket. They were slow at that time of year. It was cold, sort of sluggish, and so we just filled this basket up with snakes. And
or stay grass?
There are grass snakes, the old garter snake. A few old bull snakes in there. We'd clean the thing out, and then this yard guy would go down and turn in the water, and our old Ralph Fisher would give us $10. The problem was what to do with all the snakes. And I think one time we had an answer which probably wasn't the best. Alan Cadwell had two daughters. Their reaction to snakes was always quite classic. And we got the idea that there would really be a reaction if the snakes were in the house. And so we noticed that one of the basement windows was open. So we just slipped the whole bushel basket down into the basement and closed up the window. Well, as the heat from the house warmed up the basket, and the snakes came to life. And they were gone, as I recall, over a weekend. When they returned, the house was just alive. And it was literally crawling with snakes everywhere they turned.
It's just terrible.
They were fucked out.
Well,
they didn't have to think very hard.
But they stayed in the hotel for a couple of days, and the fireman came and just cleaned the house.
You should have volunteered
the snakes.
Could have used them again.
Another $10.
The thought had occurred to us.
Well, they were in your own basement once.
Oh, yeah. I had one that was a pet. He got loose. And we had a laundry lady who was deathly afraid of snakes. I was called out of school by my mother. Brought home, my mother said, my laundry lady has quit. And this is a very serious situation here in the war because people weren't available. What is the problem? Well, she was going downstairs, and she got halfway downstairs, and the snake dropped from the ceiling into the laundry basket.
Oh.
The laundry basket, I could see the laundry basket was at the base of the stairs. The clothes were just like the clothes were all over the basement, and she was nowhere to be seen. And I had to personally go over and ensure that I caught my pet and had been properly disposed of. We got her back.
Well, we had a help out here, and Craig and his friends swiped the SAE Lion. Remember the SAE Lion? Everybody is always up in the field. Paid out every time they had a little. Sigma Chi decided that they'd go swipe that lion. And the first thing I knew, I had a lion out here in my smokehouse. And this woman that worked for us didn't know about being there. Somewhere or other, she opened the smokehouse door. And there was a lion
sitting face. It was dark enough in there that she probably didn't.
What was that?
It was Scotty.
It was Scotty, not the deer.
Oh my God! Actually, they didn't have.
Then we had a squirrel that used to run around with. But when the woman's hanging out clothes, or they were hanging out clothes, why the skirt was the squirrel running right up skirts or pant leg and out along her arm and out the clothes.
Oh, name of Andrew.
That was a nice little squirrel.
Well, you had an old gas engine you bought.
Well, yeah, tell that story. Was that the one that was out on the dump? Or?
Yeah, I think this was right after the war. And there was an old Z engine.
I wonder where that ever went.
And
that is the one cylinder one,
you bought that.
I remember the price. It was $1. And I think we got it from your hand. I don't know whether you ever saw the dollar or not, but we got the engine.
Well, this was the one that was out on the dump, huh?
Yeah. And I remember hauling it. We had to haul it with a wagon all the way into town. And back then we were building these little, what they call them, go-karts today, but the Maytag was the most popular engine. We decided, well, a larger engine would give us more power. We didn't have any perception of how much a Z engine weighed or really how large it was. But we got this thing in, and we spent hours on that thing. I remember knocking the piston was frozen and getting it all unstuck.
The Z.
Taking it apart, going over the thing and cleaning it. I remember my mother complaining of the kerosene fumes permeating the house. Of course, everything had to be cleaned. That was the only solvent we had. But we got the thing cleaned up and assembled, and one of our friends' father worked at Fairbanks and got a manual. So we put the thing together. We determined how to put the spark right and so forth. But we couldn't start it. And we didn't have enough strength to flip the flywheels to get the thing started. You had to flip it against compression and let it go, and at our age, we could do that. So we arrived at a scheme. There was a big pulley on it. We'd wrap a rope around the pulley, well, maybe six or eight times. And then we'd hold the intake valve in, and I'd get four or five kids on the end of that rope, and they'd take off across the garage, and at the right time, I'd let the valve out, and we'd have enough momentum to where the thing would go. And it was a beautiful scheme. The only one thing was that we didn't realize that you had to let the valve in at precisely the right time so it wouldn't kick. Well, they all lined up. We had the rope wound up, and they took off in about six turns, and the thing was really spinning. And I let it out at the wrong time. And every one of them laid back. That engine reversed, and put them right back like dominoes on the garage floor, all six of them. And it was several weeks before I could get the courage up to ask him again to get my engine going. We finally did get it going.
Well, now it's like an R game scene. That's one of the stories I particularly remembered because it was associated with the farm. And so I could use it in this particular story. But as I recall, you said that they had the farm did have a dump that you guys used to haunt to see what interesting was being thrown away.
We'd be out on that dump like every weekend. And hopefully it would be something new. One time there was a milking machine. The old days, you had a portable milking machine, vacuum pump, and you ran them off of an electric motor engine. And when they got worn, they just threw them out. And the thing had a great deal of appeal because at that time we were interested in correcting water. And we connected the idea that a milking machine pump could run and pump air. And if you could pump air, then you could breathe underwater. This was the day before scuba breathing. So we swiped the milking machine pump off the dump, and we connected the milking machine pump to not the Z but another smaller engine. By that time, we got fairly professional with these things, and we put this whole contrivance on a wagon and went down a Turtle Creek. And we had garden hose that we connected to the pump, so the pump was really running backwards and supplying air instead of back to the milking. Blowing it. And the garden hose was connected to the pump. On the other end of the garden hose, we had some more surplus gas mills. These were the ones that we put over your head with the straps. And we took the canisters off, and then they had a flexible hose on them, and we jerry-rigged another garden hose connection on that. And so with this thing pumping, you could wear these masks and dive underwater and stay underwater for a considerable length of time. And so our first experiences at skin diving were contrived from one of your old pumps, and we learned our trade in Turtle Creek. We dived down the bottom, and I can remember feeling around that bottom.
It's a wonder you could see in that quick.
You really couldn't see. I just remember sort of a brown fog, but the thrill of being underwater, not having to come up for air, was something that was new to us, and something no one else could do. We feel around the bottom, and we catch these big turtles in the springtime. The water was still quite cool and somewhat clear. You could see a little bit of what you were doing. It'd be these big leatherback turtles. And we catch them, and somebody at Blood College is using them for an experiment. I forget what it was, but there was an experiment going on. And we got something like a dollar a turtle. And we flooded that chap with turtles. He finally shut us off. He never did figure out how anybody could catch that many turtles out of such a small.
They bite. I remember one of that was very ugly.
Yeah, hog nose used to bite.
Yeah.
And we got to know how to handle the situation. When you'd work your hand along, as soon as you felt a mound, you were down the bottom, you'd push down on the mound, and invariably, the head end would come up, as they like to dig back down. So as soon as you started moving back in the mud, then that was the end of graph. And then you brought these out, kicking and screaming out of the water.
I had a one-armed milk delivery man a number of years ago. And every spring he would go out with some paddle or other along Turtle Creek and spear a snapping turtle. Mm-hmm. And he supplied me with several turtle steaks. Mm-hmm. But that was a new idea for me. But here's something you missed at the bottom of the dump.
Turtle steaks? Did you ever fix them?
No.
Fantasy.
And my nephew, Carl and Joe's son, worked at KSJM.
Really?
And he knows Garrison. I tried to get a hold of Danny Fosbury before I came to hopefully pass on a message to Garrison Reed. Cousin's birthday, he's a doctor in Minneapolis too. Dr. Fagan Beaver Street, the doctor, Jerry in Minneapolis, and something out with Paul. I couldn't get a hold of Jerry. It was a good thought.
Does Carl work for WHA?
He's at the university, yes.
He's been at WHA, and I don't know if
he's there too. He's doing other things.
Well, he was chapter a day for many, many years.
Yeah. Now he started that.
And then he's been doing earplay.
These are the
national figures. Mm-hmm. You know, a junkyard and a library are a lot alike. Because
good.
You know, they're a source of knowledge. And in the war, you know, knowledge was scarce. The source we had were dumps and scrap drives. People would throw things out during a war that they normally wouldn't throw out. So you could pick up very nice mechanical devices, particularly if they're heavy in copper and iron. And remember the dump out here, one thing. Particularly, I can't remember what it was, a T-coil, model T-coil, or an electric fence coil. But anyway, it was an old buzzer coil with the vibrator on it, designed for the so-called hotshot battery. And we were just into understanding electricity at the point where you could get something like this running, and there were two things you could do with a coil that were really effective. One was to jam your neighbor's radio by tying the coil to the wire clothesline, and that destroyed radio reception. The other was you could give a shock to a person, and again, you know, it's all and I think probably the best application of the coil was the Turtle Grange auction. Auction that was held every spring.
Well, that's good too, because I mean that ties it even more with the farm, because you got the coil out of the dump. Okay.
And once we became proficient in how to wire the coils and use them, then your knowledge expands. With knowledge expands research, and research means you have to go out and try new things. And we pretty well shocked everyone. The Cadwell girls had become numb, and we had run this thing around school, and there really wasn't. We had to expand the new horizons.
And you're still close to Cadwell girls.
And the auction presented a rare opportunity because, first of all, there were a lot of people there we didn't know. And secondly, the auction at Turtle there, they had a outhouse that was unique in its construction. By this time, we'd mastered the idea of a circuit and grounding. And the outhouse had a metal floor and a metal eaves trough that was used to conduct during the operation. And we had determined, and quite correctly, that if you put one wire to the eaves trough and one to the metal grid on the floor, then a connection would be made eventually. And so this was the scheme developed into, at the auction, we wheeled a wagon in with a battery. We had an old car battery, this coil, and we connected the thing up. And I remember hiding behind the outhouse. I was going to listen for the telltale sound, and then
one of my cohorts was hiding over by the Turtle Town Hall, and he'd give the high sign of someone going in, we had this thing all laid out. Well, I recall that he was waving his arms, and then I heard the door slam, and I took it as the sign. What he really was trying to tell me was that the sheriff had just walked in. Well, I, of course, heard all the goings on, and I made the circuit. And, you know, there's certain sounds that are etched in your mind, but this one was a combination between it sounded a cross between, I think, a bull in the field and a Ford horn. And there was a lot of noise, and my partner headed out across the field down towards Helderson's farm. And then I realized something was wrong. So I took the best route out and I started to run. And I remember looking back because I heard a lot of laughter. And the only thing that saved us was the sheriff was trying to run with his pants down.
Now this was Maxworthy, wasn't it?
I think so.
Uh-huh.
How old were you?
It wasn't Maxworthy, sort of fat?
Yeah, this fellow was quite overweight. His pants were down. He had totally lost his composure. And he made it about halfway across the parking lot, went flat on his face. We went down and we spent the afternoon under Helderson's barn. And until dusk came. And I think he probably spent several weeks looking. And the only thing I can remember is we left the wagon there, we left the coil. And the following year, we went back to the auction. And there was a wagon for sale. And
is that yours or mine?
We didn't have the courage to bid on it. Someone else.
It was your wagon.
It was our wagon. Someone else. And I swear that chair was waiting there to see who was going to bid on that wagon.
Minus the coil and the.
Minus the coil and the back.
Well, I used to run a little group out here for kids called the Tri-Y group, started by a boy that was lonesome. Mm-hmm. That was before everybody could get to town, you know. Mm-hmm. And he became a lone scout. And I ran across him and got some other fellas together and we met at houses, that sort of thing. And Maxworthy was one of the boys. And one game we played was a great game. It was called SWAT. Guy would line up like this against the wall and somebody'd run up to him, the whole crowd would run up to him. Somebody in the crowd would come down as hard as they could. You'd get an awful lot of pressure, you know, with a run and if you time your swing right and drive him almost through the wall. When he'd have to turn around and tell you who hit him. And I remember that we used to beat back for him to beat the band. But the latest story I had was when I was eight some years ago when he was here. We were entertaining, one of Craig's children out here who went to turn at school. And he woke me up one morning, one night about 1 o'clock, and he said, wouldn't you like Aspen's autograph? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, so-and-so Normington and somebody's son, I brought you Aspen's photograph, and we've got an autograph, and we have it out in the garage. So what those kids had done was to park their car in the gravel, not the gravel pit, but the lime pit below the town hall. Then they went up on Milwaukee Road and tore down an Aspen sign when he was first running. Mm-hmm. It was a big, great big piece of plywood. And so those kids dragged their sign down and got it on their car, and they had to have the sign on top of the car and hold it. They brought it over here and put it in my garage. Well, I got a reputation of supporting some Republican candidates, and I could imagine the story that could be made out of You hear what Ron Dogan has done. So I called up Baxter the next morning and explained the situation to him. And so he drove by. I told him I went to Jerry Stiffley, Jeffrey boys. So he drove up in his police car and gave him what for and said that he could hold him for it, but he'd overlook it this time if they would put the sign back. So I got a pickup truck. The boys loaded the sign on the pickup truck. I drove over to the side that had been torn down. And the sheriff followed right along behind him. put the sign back up again.
Poor Barney thought he was doing rather good deed to get the aspirin off.
Better finish the story, though.
Huh?
Better finish the story.
Finish the story?
About Barney didn't learn his lesson.
Oh, yeah. See, back in a year or two ago, back in Oregon, Barney was driving a car while his friends were picking up the yard signs they didn't like. And I don't know how they got picked up. Where did they store them?
Over in your garage? No, not in our garage. One addition to the story is that when the kids helped him pick up the signs, was the son of the lady who was running. He didn't want to go in either. they were caught and given community
work.
Oh, 24 hours of community work. That they had to go back and put all the signs up.
Seems to me that Bart wasn't very smart.
That's what you said. He didn't learn from the first step. He rationalized. He said, well, I was only driving. That doesn't cut the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see that cat jumping out of that puddle.
He was moving.
Like Mr. Larson. Yeah.
Well, I remember another story related to a farm here. Down there was a World War II camp for German prisoners of war in Rockford, on the island down there. And which our recollection of Germans came from the movies and the screens. German was sort of something that was 10 feet tall and huge and strange looking. We really didn't. We had our own made-up ideas of the enemy. I remember we were out walking along the creek. We'd been out here along what was called Deadbed. And we walked down to the conference of Deadbed in Turtle Creek across the old trestle. And we used to walk around the side of that hill where the tracks separate. Because on the backside it was steep and we could shoot a rifle into the side of the hill without any danger. And I saw smoke coming up, three or four of us, there was smoke rising. And we didn't think much of it because a lot of times deserters or bums jump the trains. And when they slowed down there, the switch got off and camped there. And we really didn't, I don't think we were afraid of them, but on the other hand, I don't think we actively solicited their attention. We came around, and I remember these two chaps sitting there. For some reason, we walked fairly near them, and the one chap got up and started walking over to us. He spoke rather slowly, and he was asking about where the place was. And again, it didn't mean anything to us because anybody who jumped the train wouldn't know where it was. So we told him where he was and so forth, and the other one was silent. And as we left, the other one got up and gave me a coin. And I looked at the thing, I just put it in my pocket. I figured that was money for telling him, giving him directions. He seemed to want to be heading towards Milwaukee. And I got home, and my mother said, we'll go out and get the evening paper. And got the paper right across the headlines with two escaped German prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so I went upstairs, and I looked at the coin, and of course it was a German coin. And I It was about a half hour. I couldn't figure out what to tell my mother. I knew I'd be in trouble for not saying anything, and then I'd be abetting these escapees. And I was trying to arrive at this decision. My mother had the radio on. She said, "Come on downstairs." And I came down, and she was listening. She said they just captured two escaped Germans out near Clinton, and taken back. And so the coin was in my hand. I remember going downstairs, throwing it in the furnace. That was it. I don't think we ever discussed it, but that was our brush with the war. We never talked about it, but those were the men.
We had some working for us.
Did we, Dad?
Prisoners?
Yeah. They had a camp at that time. I think there was a second. I heard a story from Mr. Loomis. He was in Rock for many years.
South Beloit.
Doesn't matter. Anyway, he said that he had an experience with German prisoners up in Rockford.
Camp Grant.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be Camp Grant over
World War II. Yeah.
Anyway, they had a group of them up to Detassel Corn, to DeKalb. And they just savaged the people.
So they stopped it down.
Well, you remember the creek during, well, like it was last week during flood stage?
Yeah.
And the old bridge down here used to be a trestle. There was always ice jams because there was a center limestone pier right at the old railroad bridge below Valley Road.
Yeah.
And invariably the ice would get up against that thing and back up the water. And the people from the Milwaukee Railroad would come up and dynamite the ice. And of course we were quite attracted to the explosions and the dynamiting because, again, with the war, we communicated with the enemy, and there was something about hearing an explosion that sounded something like what you'd seen on the newsreels. And I distinctly remember one spring, as we walked along the creek after the ice had gone down, finding these brown sticks. And of course, they were dynamite. They hadn't exploded, but railroad people were rather careless. Half the time, they just throw the stuff over and then we confused them. And we knew enough about dynamite, and we'd seen enough. Of course, the little fellows loading the caps. And we garnished a fairly good collection of dynamite caps, which we kept hidden down there. I think the one use we had for it was cut the stick about 2 inches long and put it behind the target, and then when you hit the bullseye, of course it was quite a pop behind the thing because it would go off and make a big cloud of smoke and look like a miniature mortar and very effective. So a lot of it got used up in that regard. But I remember one almost disastrous use. There's an old house located on Emerson Street called the Shepherd House. It was a beautiful old Victorian home, which I think the Ludies ended up with the thing shortly before the war, and it was slated to be demolished, and all their workers went to the war effort, so the place was abandoned during the war. It became a neighborhood place it was a playground. We gradually tore the thing down. We removed all the lead from the roof for scrap rise. We took all the cast iron weights out of the window for scrap rise. We tore all the wood out of the flooring for building cabins and tree houses and so forth. Gradually the thing was reduced down to sort of a little bit of brick and rubble in this old tower. And again, today you talk about people being swayed by television. Well, we remembered seeing bridges being blown up and so forth. The connection was made. Why not see if we could take the last bit of this map, a little bit of the dynamite. The experiment, I think, was ultimately successful. And the only problem was that I don't really remember an explosion. It was sort of muffled because the stuff was rather wet and rather weak. But I remember two sounds, sort of this muffled explosion as the thing came down, and then the house next door, the glass coming out of some of the windows on the side of the house as the concussion hit the side of the house. So again, we ended up did a lot of window replacement after that experiment.
That was the Carey house, Dad. Huh? That was the Carey house.
That was the old Carey house. Mm-hmm. And, I don't think he ever figured out what caused the thing. He thought it, the thing had just fallen down.
Was there a Bailey, an old postman, married a younger woman, living in that shepherd house?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think he was one of the last.
Last ones.
Well, the Hinshaws were in there for a while, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
When the place was in bad shape, because I visited once.
Well, you mentioned the Bartholomews. Mm-hmm. What is the wife's first name?
Ellie.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're the sister in law of Lucy.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where are they now?
Well, Mr. Bartholomew died, Mrs. Ellie Bartholomew lives in Florida.
I knew they were traveling a great deal. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about Lucy and her Bartholomew?
They're still alive. Around.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Lucy Sons still lives banker in Chicago, remember?
Yeah.
Who's a banker
in Chicago? He works with the first.
Lucy's son.
The son of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is his name? Rod?
Tom.
Tom.
Who were the ones you pulled out of the water?
That was Lucy.
Lucy's son, Tom.
He was Lucy's son, Tom. Is that the only child they had?
No, they had other children.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I remember.
I don't know.
They were young.
But
well,
she still has a house.
I pulled Lucy out of Turtle Creek during one of these floods.
You saved her life and the boy.
Wasn't the culvert?
Well, really helped on the other side, too. They both
it was actually Deadbed that you pulled them out of.
Yeah.
How did they get down there?
Well, when they tore down the bridge, the big red steel bridge,
yeah.
They put in some culverts instead. And they're there now. And the culverts will not take flood water.
Mm-hmm. I know where
they are. That's back up the water. And I was driving toward town. And it was a chilly spring day, ice was breaking up, and I saw a woman on the opposite side of this flood of water, just distracting, spitting.
There were a lot of those great big pieces of ice that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
It
was pretty clear water, but the ice had broken up.
But the floes were up on the bank, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, I expect. But anyway, here she was, and as I watched, I stopped my car at the end of the water and decided that I'd drive through it. It was a foot deep or so, or more. And as I watched her, she ran to the north side of the road and jumped into a creek and disappeared. Mm-hmm. Well, I immediately drove my car to the middle bridge over the culvert. And being no hero and having no idea what I was going to do, she disappeared. Well, it really experience for me, that part of it, realizing that I was a coward. I
you jump. Didn't know what to do. It would have been dumb to jump in after her.
Well, I figured
where was she?
That's what he did.
At any rate, just at that time, my son-in-law, Louis Dalvin, coming from town, stopped at the end of the water, saw me standing up to my knees in water with a big heavy overcoat on, and couldn't make himself heard over the roar of the water. And I finally made myself there. And so he ran the north side a little bit, and as he got over there on the north side of the stream, boy was working his way out, farther down.
He had fallen in, and she'd gone in, Lucy had gone in after him. And she went down through the culvert.
Well, it did occur to me that Lucy was probably sucking him out of the culvert. Well, all it would take was there would be a branch in there. But I was looking down at this whirlpool coming out of the culverts, and here it looked like a bear down there just rolling around in the water. So I jumped into the hole, and by that time the water in the hole was well up my shoulders. And I grabbed this bear, and it was in the fur coat. And I pulled it ashore. By that time, Louie got back. And she didn't want to spawn any little chicken. And again, my lack of experience and an emergency came to the fore. I said, Louie, you see if you can resuscitate this woman, and I will get the ambulance for the police. And so Louie started working on her. And you know a little about resuscitation, I guess. And so I looked through the water on the Milwaukee Road and turned to left of Milwaukee Road, and just I got on the Milwaukee Road and was in a squat car. So I started wandering around like this, and hit one curve and then off and hit the other curve. The squat car stopped, the door snapped open, and two policemen jumped out. Guns in their hands.
Oh.
I explained to them what happened. Two words, down the Turtle Creek, drowning. And then I was right by Mrs. Solems. The reason I was going to town was because Vera was at a meeting at old Mrs. Solems.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up to the door and got from the door, and I said, I've got to go back to Turtle Creek. But there's a woman drowning down there. Her has been drowned.
Very soaked, wet from head to foot.
So I drove back, and by the time I got back there, they had an ambulance and were loading her in January. I mean, I wasn't 3 minutes really, did
Well, the interesting part of that was that after Lewis helped the little boy and got him, I thought, so he was safe, and she knew it. And she was very ill for a long time, and had pneumonia and everything. And the only thing that ever got into the paper for a medicine, and it said the two policemen.
Anyway,
it was Louie and Dad.
The
two of them together.
Policemen never would have been there otherwise. When was that? How long ago was that?
Oh, you're still here in New York, and you've been gone 15 more years.
Mrs. Bartholomew would know.
And they replaced that red bridge in about 1950.
Well, Pat and Louie were married in 49, and
it was
some years after that.
Well, I didn't see Mrs. Bartholomew after that for quite a while. She had this dog and moving place.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 months later, I was driving by there, and I thought I had better see her. So I went in and said hello to her, told her who I was, and we fell into each other's arms.
She had written me, too. She said, I still have nightmares thinking that I'm going to drown
after
you
die.
Well,
didn't she paint
the
picture of the farm, too?
No, that wasn't.
That was
around it.
There were two pictures that were painted of the farm, and I thought...
One was Kiddo, architectural drawing, really.
Well, there was one on burlap.
One on burlap was aerial...
Amen. Lucy offered to do a portrait?
Yes.
Well, that's why I associate it with...
And we didn't take her up on it, because at that time Patty was doing portraits, and we had Diesel hooked up around.
And her husband was ill.
And her husband was ill.
Mr. Bartholomew?
Yeah.
That's why I asked if you were still alive.
That painting reminds me of a story. We used to been swimming in the creek in the summer. That creek was really nice because you could jump off the railroad bridge, and there was a deep hole right under the bridge there.
Is this the railroad bridge
down here in the corner?
That's a bigger one.
You'd jump off that thing, and there was a nice dive down and into the cool water. And, after a hot day in muggy Wisconsin heat, there was something about it. And I don't think it ever occurred to us to wear anything. We never wore any clothes. We just took our clothes off and went swimming. And
now, was this way down by the railroad bridge?
By the railroad bridge.
Oh, down in there.
Yeah, because dead bed where it crossed.
Yeah, I know.
Are right where it was too down? Shallow.
Yeah. Are we take canoes out?
No, beyond that.
Yeah.
And I don't think we never saw anyone down there. Or no one seemed to bother us. But for some reason, one of the younger teachers at the college decided to take our art class down to do some painting out in the country. And the closest place to the country to this person was to come down to the college stadium and walk out the railroad tracks. And so we were all doing right well there, and I remember that there were about seven of us lined up on top of